Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and that is Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda. This summer, we're looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turned 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. The music historians say 1971 was a particularly important year. Joining me now to talk about Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda and how it was shaped by its time, and also why it's gaining popularity now more than ever, is Andy Beta, a music writer whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more. Thanks for doing this, Andy. Welcome to WNYC.
Happy to be here, Brian.
And let's start really basic. Some listeners might be asking themselves, Alice Coltrane, any relation to John Coltrane, the legendary jazz composer and saxophonist? So let's begin with a little background on, yes, John Coltrane's spouse. Can you give us a brief introduction to her life up until she met her husband, John Coltrane?
Yes. Alice Coltrane was born Alice McLeod in Detroit in 1937. And she started her career playing the piano and organ in a local Baptist church. And it's probably a little bit lost to time, but, you know, after the war, Detroit was the industrial center of the country, and it was also a bebop hotspot. So you had Donald Byrd, Yusef Lateef, Elvin Jones, Cecil McBee, and a lot of other jazz players all came out of Detroit's hometown scene. And Alice's own family was a musical family. Her mother played in the church choir. Her sister Marilyn went on to become a songwriter at Motown. And her half-brother, Ernest Farrow, was a prominent jazz bassist in the city. And so she, you know, took up piano and organ at an early age and started playing in these churches and in the city and experienced what she called the gospel experience of her life. It was a very formative early experiences for her. And as she grew up, her half-brother encouraged her to kind of keep at it. So she kept playing jazz, played bebop, married a scat singer, and moved to Paris, where she was mentored by another bebop legend, Bud Powell, before her marriage ended and she wound up back in Detroit, which is where she joined a vibraphonist there by the name of Terry Gibbs. And they began playing in Detroit, and they landed this gig opening for the John Coltrane Quartet in 1963. And, you know, soon after that, John and Alice were together.
Did John and Alice Coltrane record together before his death in 1967?
Many times. There was, you know, at this point in time, the John Coltrane Quartet was one of the most beloved jazz bands working at that time. But by 1965, the pianist McCoy Tyner and drummer Elvin Jones left the group. And soon after, Alice took over the role as pianist in the band.
Despite the ethereal sounds of harp and saxophone that we heard in the intro to this segment, and we'll play a few more track excerpts from Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda as we go. Despite those ethereal sounds of harp and saxophone from that title track and in the whole album, it was born out of grief, we should say. John died of liver cancer in 1967, and according to an article in Pitchfork, the story goes that John Coltrane had ordered that harp but died before it could arrive. Could you elaborate on that story a little bit for us and the role of the harp on this album? Not an instrument you hear in jazz a lot.
Right. It's very much, you know, an album without a lot of history in the form. And I guess it should be known that, you know, in the 1960s, John Coltrane was, like many people in America, he was a seeker. He was reading the Bhagavad Gita, studying meditation, yoga. You know, it was very much of that time. And his sound began to change dramatically as he was pushing towards something, you know, that wasn't jazz, that wasn't necessarily blues, that could somehow embrace Indian classical, North African music, it was, you know, he called it a universal sound, and, you know, he himself didn't live to sort of realize this, and that sort of became Alice's mission. And in the Coltrane house itself, you know, he had a drum kit. He was studying, like, with wooden flutes, and he was always sort of trying out new instruments. I mean, most famously, you know, he picked up the soprano saxophone and, you know, learned that, and that became the instrument he used on, you know, his biggest work, My Favorite Things. And I think it's something along those lines that led him to sort of order this harp for his wife. And, you know, as you said, it's harp is a rare sound in jazz without much precedent. So I sort of imagine this gift for his wife as pushing towards new sounds and new possibilities. And we mentioned that, you know, John passes from liver cancer, and it was incredibly abrupt. He sort of complained about being in pain in May of that year, and 6 weeks later was gone. And, you know, she was left a widow by the age of 30 with her daughter from a previous marriage and three young sons that she had with John Coltrane. And then, you know, reeling with all this, this harp shows up. And she told Ebony magazine at the time, "I know it is his invisible hand that brought me through." So no doubt this harp arrives, and it's sort of this sign from beyond, for lack of a better description.
That's a haunting story. I see that a few Alice Coltrane and Satya Dhananda fans are calling in, and we'll take your phone calls in a minute, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, as we continue our series on important albums in music that came out 50 years ago this year, 1971, considered an unusually important year in music and their social context. Today, it's Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satya Dhananda, with Andy Bader, music writer, whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more, 646-435-7280. But before we take a few calls and hear some more music excerpts, if there's a reason why people might not be so familiar with Alice Coltrane as compared to John, even though her popularity is rising these days, so long after her own death. You wrote in a recent article in the Washington Post that in jazz circles, Alice Coltrane was maligned and disparaged in a manner that I guess we could say anticipated the sort of vitriol that would be dumped on other spouses of beloved male rock stars like Yoko Ono and Courtney Love. So can you talk about why critics were so harsh toward her solo work at first?
You know, at the time, the Coltrane Quartet, as I said earlier, was one of the most beloved jazz groups of the time. They were just, you know, formidable. Nothing could stop them, you know, when they made so many classic albums. And then you see, you know, this sort of break up, you know, but McCoy Tyner leaves, Elvin Jones leaves, and for one reason or the other, this blame is sort of put onto Alice, right? Like, she's the reason they broke up, and, you know, it very much parallels this idea of, oh, it's Yoko Ono that breaks the Beatles up. The Beatles couldn't break up on their own. It had to be this outside force, this woman that comes in, and she's the one that makes, you know, this breakup possible. And I just think, you know, there was just these other elements where, you know, obviously Coltrane himself was undergoing these changes. And so instead of imparting it onto him, where, you know, John Coltrane himself is almost a sainted figure in jazz and in 20th century music. And so if he can do no wrong, then who is to blame for this? And, you know, unfortunately it becomes Alice, because, you know, with his passing, Alice has control over the tapes and all the recordings he made in the years leading up to his death. And so, you know, as some of this music starts to come out posthumously, there's these other elements that she adds to these tapes. The most, you know, noteworthy is this album called Infinity, where she adds in another bass player, Charlie Hayden, who played with Ornette Coleman, and she adds strings and these other things, and which is basically heresy in jazz, right? Like, you know, overdubbing's frowned upon, adding these things after the performance is greatly frowned upon. And so, you know, she just dealt with, you know, criticism for her own work, and then for how dare she add these elements to John Coltrane's music. And in 2002, she sort of addressed these criticisms in an interview with The Wire magazine, where she was saying, you know, here's all these people saying, we know that the original recording didn't have any strings, so why didn't you leave it as it was? And, you know, her response was, well, were you there? Did you hear John's commentary and what he had to say? And, you know, goes on to say, we had a conversation about every detail. John was showing me how here these other sounds, blends, tonalities, and resonances, you know, these things could all sort of be in there. And as she argues, she was actually carrying out his vision by bringing these other elements in and, you know, taking his music to places that, were he to live, he probably would have done himself. But, you know, this became her role, carrying the torch of his vision forward, and the, you know, the slings and arrows that she faced because of this.
Interesting and important historical context there. So who gets to play the role of saxophonist after the death of her husband, John Coltrane, on Alice Coltrane's classic Journey in Satya Dinanda? It's Pharoah Sanders. So let's listen to just a little bit of his playing on the song from the album Stopover Bombay. Janine in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janine. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Brian. I just wanted to say thank you so much for featuring this Alice Coltrane. She is amazing. And throughout COVID, one of the many things I do is as an artist, I'm a conscious dance facilitator. My form that I share is rhythm therapy. And I was prepping for an online class because I've taken my classes online early on in the pandemic, and I found this through Spotify, and it just helped me through this whole year, finding a black hippie, an old school black hippie from, and I was born in 1970, so I was one when this came out, and it's like, finding her was like finding a friend that I never knew existed, because I've been, you know, now there's been an upsurgence of black folks doing yoga and kinetic yoga and connecting to the African roots of yoga and spirituality in that way. And this music just blends the American form of jazz with ancient forms, with the harp and with African rhythms in such a way that during all of the chaos of COVID and last year with all of the social justice stuff with George Floyd, just to be able to lean into this music was a way that my mind and a lot of my students' minds were able to rest. So thank you for featuring this, and thank you to the expert for giving more perspective about Coltrane, about the couple, about their kids, and I just want to thank you so much. I lost my mom on the 11th, and literally I was listening to this as part of my healing. And it's just, you know, music really does make a difference. And so thank you for featuring
this,
and I hope that more folks will listen.
Thank you, Janine.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you so much. Wow. So, Andy first, black hippie. Do you second that description of Alice Coltrane from back in the day? And what about her rising popularity now? I mean, more family context. Her son, Robbie Coltrane, is a well-known jazz saxophone player these days. The producer and rapper Flying Lotus is her grandnephew. Worked with artists like Kamasi Washington, Thundercat, even Kendrick Lamar. So there's a kind of, I think, hip-hop-influenced spiritual jazz music. That's the context for which Alice Coltrane is making a posthumous comeback. So what can you say about any of that?
Well, I just sort of speak to Janine's point, and you know, whether I would call her a black hippie, you know, what she and John were doing definitely predates the sort of rise in hippiedom. And one could argue that John Coltrane's example sort of inspired these other musicians and rock to sort of take on this expanded, you know, consciousness and to learn more beyond like Western civilization and Western history. And, you know, the era we're talking about is very much about upheaval and, you know, the social ills of the time. And along with John Coltrane, you know, jazz became more fiery, more chaotic, more angry. And you've also had artists like Abby Lincoln and Nina Simone, who were growing more and more sort of politically outspoken. And also someone like Marvin Gaye, who's, you know, What's Going On also comes from the same time. And, you know, really tackling these ills and, you know, these issues that are still present with us and, you know, police violence, war, poverty, inequality, drug abuse, death. And obviously, as we've seen in the last year or two, like these ills are still with us and very much still a problem in our society. And, you know, for many people who went through the last year and a half, is like, well, what do you do about it? And what's crucial for Alice is she turned inward. You know, you can call it, you know, in today's parlance, like, oh, it's self-care, it's spiritual self-preservation. And, you know, amid all of this, Alice was seeking sort of a higher wisdom. And, you know, everything around her is angry mm-hmm. and, you know, engaged. And here she is in this way that would just be really baffling at the time. You know, it's like introspective, it's contemplative, it's gentle and impressionistic. And, you know, I think a lot about sort of Christ's message in Luke 17:21, where it says, behold, the kingdom of God is within you. And Journey in Satchidananda is that exactly, because when you think about taking a journey, you think about you're going somewhere, you're traveling, you're visiting something. And, you know, just in the name itself, it's Journey in Satchidananda. It's this inward journey that she's taking.
It's in the music. It's not to. That by itself is so interesting. So she had her journey in Satchidananda, George Harrison at that time, in the middle of all the things that were swirling around him as a member of the Beatles, turned, you know, to similar kinds of spirituality. Let me get Kathleen in Jersey City. And Kathleen, I apologize for having to crunch you, but 30 seconds, I know you're calling in about Satchidananda.
Oh, yeah. I was trained at Integral Yoga on 13th Street in New York City. And I was told there was a time when Integral Yoga was petering. There was a need to raise money to purchase a building in order to continue the work Satchidananda was doing. And it just so happened that there was he decided he was going to purchase the building and he needed so much money. And it just happened that Alice Coltrane called up and said, I want to donate this amount of money. And it was the exact money, exact sum of, that he needed in order to purchase the building.
The last track we're going to listen to a little bit is the live recorded Isis and Osiris going out on this segment. But on it, listeners, you can hear Vishnu Wood playing the oud in the minor scale, and it's one of the songs on the album that sounds the saddest. We've talked so much about grief in the context of Alice Coltrane's journey in Satchidananda. And we thank Andy Beta, music writer, whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more. Wrote about the Alice Coltrane album in the Washington Post. Thanks so much for coming on, Andy. This was really interesting and moving.
Thank you so much. I was honored to be here.